Thank you for coming out for tonight's event. I'm Barbara Ransby. I teach here at UIC, and I'm director of the Social Justice Initiative. I want to thank the staff at SJI, Emily Williams and Monique Phillips, for their help in putting this evening's event together. I also want to thank Stevens publisher, Haymarket Books, Julie Fain and Jim Plank, for proposing this book event to us here at UIC, and of course for nurturing and publicizing this project. It is a bit ironic that we are hosting Stephen Salida on this day, so-called Columbus Day, given that one of his areas of scholarly expertise is Indigenous studies. And this is anything but a day of celebration for Indigenous people and all of us who refuse to forget the history of land theft and genocide that marks the Columbian legacy. Our way of marking this day, however, is not to honor Christopher Columbus, but to welcome our colleague, the distinguished scholar activist Stephen Salida. So I want to thank him for agreeing to come. I want to thank him for his voice and perseverance, and to thank him for this most recent book, Uncivil Rights: Palestine and the Limits of Academic Freedom, which we've come to hear more about this evening. A few more thank yous. I want to acknowledge the other co-sponsors of tonight's talk, my colleague Chris Boyer and the UIC History Department, Professor Walter Ben Michaels and the UIC English Department, Professor Jane Rhodes and African American Studies, Professor Jenny Breyer in the Gender and Women's Studies Program, and Professors Mark Chang and Anna Guevara in Asian American Studies. Also, I want to thank Professor Amalia Payares and the Latin American and Latino Studies Program, all co-sponsors of this evening's talk. When we were asked to co-sponsor this book event, I had absolutely no hesitation. And when I asked other departments to join us in co-sponsoring this event, they said yes very quickly as well. Why? Because we have watched Stephen Salida's case unfold, and many of us have written letters, signed petitions, and tweeted in support. And in doing so, on one level, we realize that this case is about a single individual, and I don't want to minimize that. His reputation, his career, his future have been at stake, and he and his family have suffered mightily. But I think one reason that many people have felt so compelled to speak out and so quick to say yes in support of hosting an event for Stephen Salida, support has also come far and wide. The AAUP, as many of you know, have spoken in support of this case and others across the country. But the reason is, I think, that we know it's about Stephen Salida, but on another level, it's also about us. It raises grave concerns not only about academic freedom, but about freedom of expression in general, particularly the right to dissent. If Stephen Salida does not have the right on his own time as a private citizen in the public square to tweet his opposition to Israel's assault on Gaza or Israeli policy in general, then it begs the question, do I have a right to go to a Black Lives Matter vigil on a Saturday on my own time to protest police violence toward Black communities? Maybe a student with police officers and his or her family might misread political criticism for personal animus. It begs the question if my colleagues in Latino and Latin American studies have the right to march and engage in civil disobedience in support of undocumented students and immigration reform, because maybe a nativist colleague or a Donald Trump supporter might take offense. It begs the question, does a labor historian have the right to walk a picket line with striking workers because maybe a pro-business student might feel the historian were biased against his business views and that would translate into some bias against the student with a differing point of view? These are unsettling questions. And there was a period in the not-so-distant past in this country that the answer to these questions was an unapologetic no. It was during the McCarthy period, the anti-communist witch hunts of the 1950s and 60s, a time when artists and scholars and government workers were dragged before the House Un-American Activities Committee and other investigatory bodies and demanded to know what they read, what they thought, who they associated with, and what organizations they belonged to. For those who refused to cooperate and for those who refused to implicate others, the price was high. Careers, families, and lives were destroyed. Professor Chandler Davis, a Harvard-trained mathematician at University of Michigan, was fired for refusing to cooperate with HUAC and served 6 months in prison. That is only one example. This is a period that I research in my own scholarship on Islanda and Paul Robeson, but it is also an experience that touched my own family. My father-in-law was an English professor in the early 1960s and was called before HUAC and blacklisted for his political convictions. So this is an issue around which I feel very deeply. All of this to say, we're very happy to have Stephen Salida with us tonight to engage us in a conversation about this very important question. Joining us in that conversation will be my two brilliant colleagues, Nadine Naber and Roderick Ferguson, who I will introduce after I introduce Stephen Salida. The format for this evening, too, will be that we will invite Professor Salida to the podium. He will share some remarks about the book. Then we'll invite Rod Ferguson and Nadine Naber to join us up here for some comments on his comments. And then we'll open the floor for all of you to raise questions. We invite you not to give long speeches, but to raise questions. But we really do invite questions and comments so that we can talk about this issue in an open forum, and I think it's a very important one. Okay. Stephen Salida received his PhD at the University of Oklahoma with a concentration in Native American studies, theory, and modernity. He is the author of 6 books: Modern Arab Fiction, A Reader's Guide, The Uncultured Wars, Arab Muslims and Poverty of Liberal Thought, Arab American Literary Fictions, Culture and Politics, The Holy Land in Transit, Colonialism and the Quest for Canaan, and Anti-Arab Racism in the USA, Where It Comes From and What It Means for Politics Today, which was the winner of the 2006 Gustavus Myers Outstanding Book Award, and most recently, Israel's Dead Soul in 2011 by Temple University Press. In addition to his numerous book publication, he has also authored numerous articles and numerous refereed articles and book chapters. Professor Salida was previously an associate professor and director of Literature, Language, and Culture Program in the Department of English at Virginia Tech University. He currently enjoys an appointment at American University in Beirut, Lebanon, and it's my distinct pleasure to welcome him to the podium tonight.
Can everybody hear me well? Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending your evening with us. It's a great honor and pleasure to be in conversation about these issues that are of concern to so many people. Before I get started on some comments about the book, observations about academic freedom, I want to thank the sponsoring departments at UIC, the faculty who put in work. I very much want to thank my friends and colleagues, Professor Ferguson and Professor Naber, who are just wonderful people in addition to being brilliant scholars. And then and I especially want to highlight Dr. Ransby. She's she's done this work for a long time, and the work she's done has been brilliant and necessary, and she's been a role model for so many of us who are trying our best to walk in the footsteps of the great examples that she's provided and continues to provide. So I'm deeply gratified to have her introduce this event, and I'll do my best to make it useful for everyone. So I wrote the book, or I started writing the book as a form of catharsis at first. After I received the termination letter last August 2nd, it was dated August 1st, but I received it on August 2nd from Chancellor Weiss at UIUC. I was immediately muzzled by the lawyers with whom I'd been in touch. And in those weeks, almost 2 months of silence, it was extremely difficult to observe the sorts of things that were being said, not only about me as a person, but about Palestine, about the hiring process, about what actually happened. And I think most everybody can relate to the frustration that exists when we hear things that we know simply to be untrue, but we have no means of responding, right? You know, if you want that feeling, all you have to do is turn on the corporate news and watch for 5 minutes, right? And then, you know, we'll get that feeling. And so I wrote the book, or I started writing the book, just as a way of keeping sane and keeping focused and centered and trying to think systematically about what the university's action means, what kind of, I guess, a portal my tweets entered into, and why so many people were concerned by what a professor at Virginia Tech, soon to be in Urbana, Illinois, with very few Twitter followers, was saying. Right? Why was it such a big deal? It turns out, of course, we learned later, you know, a few months ago, that a lot of people were concerned with that Twitter feed. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois was concerned with my Twitter feed. The local business elite of Urbana-Champaign were concerned with my Twitter feed. Christopher Kennedy, scion of Merchandise Mart, was concerned with my Twitter feed. And it is absolutely remarkable to me that so many people got together to discuss behind closed doors what to do about an associate professor who was tweeting criticism of the war crimes of a foreign government. Why? Why do they care so much? Why does it matter? And the answers are numerous. I try to address them in different ways in the book, and I'll try to provide a very short version right now. First of all, we tend to make a mistake in thinking that all upper administrators are inclined ideologically towards Israel or towards real ardent forms of Zionism. That's not necessarily the case. I think it's more useful to look at the ways in which Zionism functions in the corporate academy vis-a-vis Palestine solidarity activism. And if you look at where Palestine solidarity activism is located on campus, you'll find it related in many ways. Sometimes it could be better, but it's positioned around anti-police brutality activism. Right? It's aligned itself with Black Lives Matter activism. It's aligned itself with various forms of economic justice activism, very often with indigenous peoples activism, with various forms of decolonization around the globe. I'm making generalizations, but that's generally where it exists, right? In the context of sort of on-the-ground activism in academia, and that's where, most important, upper administrators and donors perceive it to exist. Zionism exists in the boardrooms adorned with thick polished mahogany tables and swivel chairs. It exists in the consciousness of the big money donors. It is, in other words, an exquisitely normative politics in the corporate structures of the neoliberal academy. It is not something with which the corporate academy feels sympathy. It is part and parcel of the very structure and maintenance of the corporate academy. To challenge Zionism in academe, as Palestine Solidarity Work does, right, as so many other student groups that are interested in justice do, is to challenge the structure of the corporate academy itself. And the moment that Palestine Solidarity Activism moves away from this orientation is the moment that it needs to be fixed and set right back on that course, because that's where it needs to exist. That's where it should exist. That's where its work becomes most important. They were also concern, they kept saying, with the safety and comfort and well-being of students. And this was a troublesome discourse on numerous levels, but it did reveal the utility of students as an invented demographic in the administrative lexicon. So when UIUC administrators and their supporters invoked the well-being of the students, they weren't talking about actual human beings, right, who take up their books and walk to actual classes and sit in actual classrooms where they receive actual instruction. They were exploiting those real students in the service of maintaining an imagined demographic that would act as a proxy for administrative interests. Because when upper administrators, and I'm sure you've noticed this, fret about students, they never mean all students. They're never fretting about black students. They don't fret about trans students. When they're worried about student safety and comfort around the Israel-Palestine conflict, I promise you, they don't mean Palestinian students. Have you ever heard an upper administrator say, "What about the Palestinian or Muslim students? What about their safety and comfort?" It is absolutely, uniformly absent from the discourses of concern about student well-being. So the students is not a neutral term. It's not a neutral concern. And then, I guess finally, I've thought a lot about the ways in which the tweets in question have been characterized. And I don't like, at this point, more than a year later, you know, providing an exegesis of my tweets. Like, it's clear now that it's not about tweets. Like, really, anybody who tells that it's about tweets. It's about tweets, really? You know, read the emails. Do you know what I mean? It's about so many other things. Get out of here. You know, I just, you know, don't be ridiculous. It always bothered me, to be quite frank, that I was being characterized as angry or as irrational. And well, I guess mostly because I don't consider myself irrational. I'm biased, but I don't. And I don't consider myself particularly angry. I don't consider myself to be an angry person. I actually very, very rarely in this world lose my temper. And you know, I've never aggressively laid my hand on another human being, and I can't imagine the circumstance in which I ever would. You know, I'm actually, you know, terribly shy and introverted in general, and so this new vision of me as angry and maniacal, you know, I had to sort of contend with and grapple with, and in that sense, I found so much clarity, right, in thinking through the history of the trope of anger as it relates to ethnic minority communities, particularly black women, but extending to other areas of, I guess, marginalized political spaces in the United States, and the ways that the horrible violence of the state can be interpolated through this perfectly rational, polite language without us ever even being given the ability to recognize its inherent violence unless we consciously search for it. I have a line in the book. I can't find it, so I'm going to have to paraphrase myself. I guess if I misquote myself, I'll get angry with myself later. But, you know, some of the worst acts of genocide in world history were applauded or planned around dinner tables, right, adorned with actual silver without a single inappropriate speech act having occurred. It's in the spaces, these spaces of power, that distinctive forms of violence germinate and justify themselves and get off the ground. And it's in the context of a particular sort of American capitalism that this violence gets deterritorialized from the spaces of the elite, right, and hung like an albatross onto the shoulders of individuals, right? And so the responsibility becomes ours alone, even though I was never actually advocating for anything violent or angry in the first place. And so that trope, how does it work? Wow. I decided that in the end, I was going to own it and be proud of it and use it as further evidence of my basic humanity, my ability to empathize. So I got to thinking. These folks got me fired. Right? They got me fired. They took away my livelihood. They threw my life into disarray. And then they acted like I had done something to them. Right? That always happens that way. You know, they were really angry at me. And I started thinking, you know, they were looking through my family history. They were looking through every word I'd ever written. You know, they were scrambling and scrambling, writing all kinds of horrible things about me. What did I do to them? I didn't do shit to these people. They did something to me. And yet I'm made, we're all made, when we're the victims of racism, when we're the victims of structural power. We're made to shoulder that responsibility and to internalize the burdens, right, that come from this sort of unethical behavior. So no, I'm going to own the anger. I'm going to own the anger. Because when I see 521 children bombed to death by a country that proclaims to be the most moral in not only in the world today, but in the history of the world, and I see images of toddlers blown to smithereens coming through my Twitter feed, then yes, that makes me angry. In fact, if it doesn't make a person angry, then that person scares the hell out of me. The person who can see the video of Freddie Gray being carried into that police van, his legs dangling beneath him because his spine has been broken, and tossed into the back of the police van like a sack of laundry, later to die in police custody, and then immediately takes the side of the police, scares the absolute hell out of me. If that doesn't make you angry, then you have serious problems of perception in this world. You have a serious lack of empathy with people who are most deserving of empathetic responses. So of course, yes, I was angry. And yes, I was offensive. But I'm also deeply offended by those who are celebrating and justifying war crimes, and celebrating and justifying police brutality, and celebrating and justifying all kinds of state violence, horrible state violence, whose adoption has become the calling card of civility in today's political climate. And I try to, I guess, think through some of these complexities in the book. A lot of it is sort of personal accounts of what this or that moment in my life looked like. But I want to, in closing up, really second the excellent points that Dr. Ransby raised about the implications of the kind of logic that the University of Illinois deployed in justifying its decision. The idea that we can find, we cannot be hostile to viewpoints, and that we have to sort of accommodate this very vague idea of student comfort and student safety, and the idea that any sort of disagreement in turn like constitutes automatically an act of bad pedagogy. And her reading of the situation is absolutely perfect. What they are telling us, in essence, because remember, these imaginary students are acting as the proxies of administrative desire. What they're asking us to do, essentially, is not to say anything that might upset centers of power. That's exactly what it translates to, and it does not take much intellectual work to distill it from its stated position, right, to its actual desire. It's a very simple and singular leap to get from one to the other. And so, yes, we are being told that our jobs now as thinkers and as teachers is not to challenge orthodoxy, not to rethink the sacrosanct, right? Not to think about ways of improving the well-being of the communities with whom we're in contact through our scholarship, through our activism, through our life experience in many cases, right? That our job is to provide students with a greater sense of brand equity vis-a-vis the protection of our university's avatar. And so remember, when they talk about us being on social media, they like it. They do. They want us on social media. They just don't want us saying the wrong things on social media, right? But if we're, Levitt, author of Freakonomics Part 350, do you know what I mean? Then the University of Chicago loves that, right? They love that Niall Ferguson over at Harvard is writing bootlicking volumes and peons to Henry Kissinger, right? They love that kind of publicity, right? It's not a matter of being visible. It's a matter of the university and the elite who are invested in the corporate structure of the university maintaining a particular brand image and a brand equity. And ideas, what any of us might consider useful or notable ideas, right, are absolutely anathema to that process. And if you think that I'm being too pessimistic, I understand. Stay in any university structure long enough and pay attention, and you might find that I'm actually being more positive than I should be. I'm looking forward to speaking more during the Q&A, but I really want to turn it over to Professors Ferguson and Nabern. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. I want to welcome Roderick Ferguson and Nadine Naber to come up here now. They're sitting there looking at me like they haven't been invited before. Two of our very brilliant, fairly recent additions to UIC through our cluster hiring program, where we are really attracting some pretty amazing people. Roderick Ferguson is the co-director of the Racialized Body Research Cluster here at UIC. Prior to his appointment here, he was professor of race and critical theory in the Department of American Studies at the University of Minnesota, serving as chair of the department from 2009 to 2012. In the fall of 2013, he was the Old Dominion visiting faculty for the Council of Humanities and the Center for African American Studies at Princeton. In 2004, he was scholar in residence for Queer Locations Seminar at at University of California's Humanities Research Institute at Irvine. And from 2007 to 2010, he was the associate editor of American Studies Association's flagship journal, American Quarterly. In the year 2000, he was awarded the MLA's Compton Knoll Award for the best essay in lesbian, gay, and queer studies. The Parvenu Baldwin and the Other Side of Redemption, Modernity, Race, Sexuality, and the Cold War, really landmark article. He is the co-editor of with Grace Hong of the University of Minnesota Press series Difference Incorporated. Also with Hong, he is co-editor of the anthology Strange Affinities, the Gender and Sexual Politics of Comparative Racialization, 2001. In addition, he's author of the amazing Reorder of Things, The University and Its Pedagogies of Minority Difference, which I highly recommend, and Aberrations in Black Toward a Queer of Color Critique in 2004, and numerous articles. He has played a leadership role in the field of queer studies and American studies, and really a powerful intellect and scholar activist who is a real example for many of us. Nadine Naber received her PhD in cultural anthropology at UC Davis, and she's an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies and Asian American Studies here at UIC. She came to UIC from the University of Michigan, where she co-founded Arab American Studies. She's the author or co-author of a number of books, including Arab America, Gender, Cultural Politics, and Activism, co-editor of Race and Arab Americans, and Arab American Feminisms, winner of the Arab American Book Award in 2012. Nadine is an editorial board member of Middle East Research and Information Project, an advisory board member of the Expanding Frontiers Interdisciplinary Approaches to Studies of Women, Gender, and Sexuality book series at U of Nebraska Press, and member of the Arab Families Working Group. She is co-founder of the Arab American Activist Network, Arab Women Activist Network, and former board member of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence. I'm reading all of these affiliations to give you a sense of the breadth of their work and that it's also engaged scholarship. They are scholar activists in the best sense of the word, and I can't think of two colleagues better positioned and prepared to comment on Stephen Salida's new book than Rod Ferguson and Nadine Naber. So.
All right, first let me thank Barbara for arranging this, and I'd also like to thank Stephen for writing the book. I also want to thank Stephen for the courage and the steadfastness that has been a model for your colleagues, some of whom you know, some of whom you don't know. But I want you to know that your inspiration, is something we carry with us. Okay? All right, now I'd like to pull out those passages in Uncivil Right that suggest how the university is the location for multiple infrastructural arrangements around race and empire. To do so, we might begin with the notion, following sociologist Susan Lee Starr, that infrastructures are made up of multiple entangled elements, platforms, and histories. And indeed, one way to read Uncivil Rights is to say that it tries to expose the various entanglements at work in the contemporary university. Take, for instance, Stephen's discussion of the Board of Trustees' use of the phrase entry not approved in reference to his firing. He writes, quote, entry not approved, a technical dictum replete with human interest but wholly oblivious to any iteration of humanity. This bureaucratic flourish forestalls emotion by deploying pragmatic judgment in a passive voice. Nobody, according to the record, is actually responsible for that judgment. Like all acts of bureaucratic management, it was done by fiat of habituation, end quote. Now, with this passage, we see the ways in which the university behaves with the dispassionate violence of the state, having very little care for human and personal costs. In this way, the phrase, entry not approved, reveals how the university contains the administrative and repressive, i.e. police, infrastructures of the state. Indeed, Salida recalls this when he notes that entry not approved evokes distinct and overlapping contexts of race, empire, and colonialism, the checkpoint that regulates the movement and evaluates the personhood of Palestinians, the whites-only signs that restricted the mobility and polemicized the humanity of African Americans, the anti-Semitic policies that barred Jews from colleges and universities. As the university invokes those infrastructures, it also expresses both its own and administrative policing powers, demonstrating how Stephen's dismissal was both an administrative matter of his employment and a policing matter concerning the presumed security of the university and its students. It's important to keep those things in mind, right? That, like, the bureaucratic practices of the university that go under the name of, nothing personal, It's just the way things work. And the policing powers of the university reveal how the administration is actually acting in models of violence laid down by state formations. Okay? Stephen goes on and states, quote, "I was thus barred from the university. In barring me, the trustees also banished a set of ideas it considers threatening, while codifying others it finds appealing based on administrative interests. The body of the dissident scholar personifies a breach of institutional virtue. He is thus banished from entry as both physical object and intellectual subject," end quote. Now, in this argument and others like it, the book touches on the fact that the racial exclusions of the university with regard to students and faculty are also the intellectual exclusions and regulations that make up the university. Various infrastructures are also expressed in those exclusions as well, with various court decisions about the viability of affirmative action programs, with the dismal decline in the number of blacks, natives, and Latinos in academic institutions. Our contemporary academic moment can be seen as one in which American colleges and universities are wrestling quite pathetically with the question of who will our institutions identify as the people, the ones with whom those institutions will produce social and intellectual contracts. Now, by way of history, Immanuel Kant's 1798 text, The Conflict of the Faculties, was the first text to identify the university as an institution that would take responsibility for the people, but always imagining them as the antithesis of the rational being of the Enlightenment. Kant's imagining of the research university in the 18th century took place within a vigorous period of racial modernity, especially where the American university was concerned. In Ebony and Ivy, race, slavery, and the troubled history of America's universities, Craig Wilder, for instance, situates the rise of such institutions as Harvard, Princeton, where Barbara said I taught, Rutgers, the University of North Carolina, Williams and Yale within the imperial and racial imperatives of the U.S. nation state. As Wilder states, quote, "American colleges were not innocent or passive beneficiaries of conquest and colonial slavery. The European invasion of the Americas and the modern slave trade pulled peoples throughout the Atlantic world into each other's lives, and colleges were among the colonial institutions that braided their histories and rendered their fates dependent and antagonistic," end quote. One of the ways in which those histories and lives were braided can be seen in the fact that American colleges and universities, along with their European counterparts, were places gaining increasing renown for developing racial sciences that sought to prove the inferiority of blacks and American Indians, thus producing a discourse that proposed that natives would eventually vanish from the land and that blacks would subsequently work it. Indeed, as one slave owner argued in his Phi Beta Kappa speech, quote, "The red men of the forest have been supplanted by a much nobler race of beings of European blood," end quote. The building of colleges and plantations were ways to prevent the, quote, "roving savages of the forest from maintaining southern lands as a savage and frightful desert," end quote. We can situate Stephen's story and many of the arguments in Uncivil Rights within an institutional and infrastructural context in which the people were always understood to be the antithesis of the intellectual possibilities of the university system, one in which people of color were deemed profoundly and indefensibly alien to the university system. All right, now I'd like to end with what I read as a provocation for all of us within the academy to engage in a politics of incivility, where infrastructures of violence within the academy are concerned. Discussing the violence of civility, Slider writes, this is the quote that you were missing, "many genocides have been glorified or planned around dinner tables adorned with forks and knives made from actual silver without a single inappropriate speech act having occurred," end quote. Through its discourse of civility and its seemingly depersonalized brutalities, the university attempts to expand its disciplinary powers, determining which speech acts, gestures, and utterances are deemed excellent, appropriate, and usable for the university's agendas. Punishing those acts, large and small, that are understood as violations of its agendas. Uncivil rights thus calls for alternative and uncivil infrastructures to counter our academic present. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Let's pause a minute so we can process everything that was put on the table. Hopefully we'll get to discuss more in the discussion. I also want to thank Barbara Ransby and SJI and the staff, and also honor Stephen for carrying the position as poster child for a longstanding struggle over asserting Palestinian narratives in the United States. With such dignity and in ways that have massively shifted the playing field, exposing not only the structures of Israeli colonialism as he has done in his work over the years, but also, especially over the past year, the structures that silence critiques of Israel in the United States, a struggle that's been decades in the making, and I think we often forget that. And, you know, this struggle was exemplified by Edward Said's words over 15 years ago when he said, "The battle over Palestine is a battle over narratives." So news reports about why Salida was fired clearly affirmed that, well, I'll say Stephen, it sounds awkward, you know. News reports about why Stephen was fired clearly affirmed that Stephen is Palestinian American and that he was tweeting in support of Palestinian rights. But among many academics supporting Salida across the U.S., the dominant trend, and I'm referring to only one trend, there were many other approaches, intentionally or unintentionally remained silent on what Salida was tweeting about Palestine, and how the particular politics of Palestine and Israel had everything to do with the firing of Salida. So there was this focus on resisting the general attack on freedom of speech and academic freedom, and this, you know, argument for faculty governance, while ignoring two equally central factors that contributed to his firing. One, the centrality of Palestine, and Stephen's Palestinian Arab heritage. So part of it, I think, was giving into fear. So there was this sense that if we also connect this academic freedom issue to the silencing of, you know, Palestinian free speech, then we will be attacked too. Also, another, I think, factor here is that there was this commitment to broadening our base. So if we make this only about academic freedom, more people will come to the rallies. But if we broaden it to Palestine, then a lot of people won't come because they'll be afraid to be labeled anti-Semitic, or they themselves contradictory position that, you know, that people supported Salida but also said that Salida was anti-Semitic. So worrying about losing those people. So today I'll discuss these factors and call for expanding the conversation or even reframing the discussion on academic freedom. My notes are really messy, so basically I'm trying to ask us to take seriously the historical and political conditions that gave rise to the firing of Salida. So I'm going to start with a comment on anti-Arab racism historically. So anti-Arab racism in the U.S. was consolidated in the aftermath of the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, when the U.S. confirmed its alliance with Israel. And with this consolidated alliance, U.S.-Israeli alliance, came anti-Arab media imagery in the U.S., which Stephen has written about all of this, anti-Arab American government policies, and anti-Arab racism in everyday life. So a brief kind of glimpse into some examples. In 1972, Nixon's Operation Boulder allowed the FBI to harass individuals, specifically Arab student activists critical of Israel, with phone calls and visits without evidence of criminal activity. It also targeted, as well, the relatives, neighbors, friends, and employers of Arab individuals. In 1987, 8 Palestinians and a Kenyan woman were arrested in Los Angeles County, targeted for removal on grounds they allegedly raised money for the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The initial charges involved the 8's effort to distribute El Hadaf, the PFLP magazine, a publication available in public libraries, on college campuses, and even at the U.S. Library of Congress. From the beginning of this case, the government admitted none of the LA 8 had committed a criminal act, yet members of the LA 8 continued to be targeting for their constitutionally protected political associations for nearly 20 years, and the case made it to the Supreme Court and was finally dropped. But this was like the case in the U.S. around the issue of should immigrants be granted the same free speech rights as citizens. And back in 84, it was already established that the targeting of Arab Americans who support Palestinian rights that produces a culture of fear, discouraging persons from expressing support for Palestinian rights, and isolates Arab American activists by obstructing the interaction and cooperation between them and other segments of U.S. society. So this is kind of like common knowledge in Arab American activist circles in the 80s. So fast forward to the aftermath of 9/11. The USA Patriot Act, as we know, adds new justifications, expanding the ability of law enforcement to place Arab and Arab Americans under surveillance, and not just Arab and Arab Americans, detain, deport, and even torture them for constitutionally protected political activities. Some of the most visible cases, Mohammed Salah, which was initiated in Israel in 1993, when Salah was arrested while distributing money to disenfranchised occupied Palestinians. He was tortured in Israel and interrogated. He then returned to the United States, where he was labeled a specifically designated terrorist, quote, by executive order with no legal process, no limitation in time, and no process to challenge this. In his high-profile 2007 trial, Israelis were feeding information to prosecutors based on Salah's confessions under torture. Also consider the 2008 conviction and indictment of Dr. Abdul Halim Ashkar for obstruction of justice and criminal contempt when he refused to collaborate with the federal grand jury's investigations of Hamas and the Palestinian anti-occupation movement. He was given the choice of informing the federal government or going to jail for criminal contempt. The U.S. government asserted that his refusal to testify before a grand jury required him to be sentenced as if he had aided and abetted terrorism. And how many people, well, Rasmi Awada's case in Chicago, I'm assuming we're familiar with, where she was over 40 years ago sexually tortured in a confession for a bombing and has been in the U.S. In October 2014, she was charged with lying on her naturalization papers, saying that she, because she allegedly said that she had not been arrested before, and they're referring to this arrest in Israel 40 years ago, and basically in the trial which happened in Detroit, the U.S. prosecution constructed her, represented her as a bomber. And they used the bombing 52 times in her trial. And the judge determined that she was not allowed to say that she was sexually tortured into the confession. So she wasn't allowed to say she was tortured, but they were allowed to call her a bombing. And actually, her appeal is October 13th in 2 days, or tomorrow. So I say all this to say that that these cases have one thing in common. Arab, Muslim, people sympathetic to Palestinian rights, targeted and represented as terrorists, their lives were ruined in one way or another, and in one way or another, they had no fair trial and no justice. So just last week, a new report was released by the organization Palestine Legal and Center for Constitutional Rights. I urge you to go check that out. I don't have time to talk much about it, but it's a whole report that we've been waiting for 20 years on the repression of free speech related to support Palestinian rights. So the report documents a suppression of Palestinian advocacy Palestine Legal, a legal advocacy organization, responded to 152 incidents of censorship, punishment, or other burdening of Advocacy for Palestinian Rights, that's in 2014, and received 68 additional requests for legal assistance. And in the first 6 months of 2015 alone, they responded to 140 incidents and 33 requests for assistance. And these are all cases related to the censorship and repression of some sort of advocacy related to Palestine. So I have a lot of examples, but I'm not going to go into them so we could have discussion the time, right? So, but all of the types of cases covered in the report include everything from cancellation of cultural events, lectures, putting on suspension, student organizations. And in all the cases, there's little or no evidence using innuendo and guilt by association to accuse the people at stake for connections to terrorism and or anti-Semitism. So it's all about publicly smearing them, destroying their careers, a grave impact on their personal lives, that it leads scholars and students to self-censor out of fear of endangering their careers. So just go to the end here. My last point is about the U.S. as a state of permanent war. And that's the other piece that I'm urging us to bring into this conversation on academic freedom. So while it's now common sense that the U.S. is a warfare state and has always been at permanent war, and its investment in military power is nearly as much as all of the military budgets of every other country in the world combined, it's often forgotten that the hyper-militarized United States bleeds into everyday domestic life, reflected in everything from university investments to the development of military arms and technology through universities, to the need of institutions to cleanse the social order of any mode of dissent willing to question its state of permanent war and its militarized neoliberalism. The suppression of dissent is one of the most serious and visible signs of the academic industrial military complex at work. So while I've mentioned many complex issues and struggles, my point is that we need to expand our political language and work towards broader social movements that can connect the dots between the US-led war agenda, generalized struggles for academic freedom and fairness in faculty governance, and the struggles against the racialized repression of Palestinian, Black, Indigenous, Asian American, and Native scholars and students who are challenging the status quo, and the interconnected struggles to end the war on higher education and the privatization and militarization of the university. SELIDA, dissenting professors, and the entire enterprise of higher education are under attack. And it's more urgent than ever that we broaden or even reframe the language of academic freedom, make our campuses Palestine free speech zones, demand that our universities are not for sale or open for surveillance, demand accountability for university police arrests of African American professors, and much, much more. Thank you.